So today's talk, I'm tentatively giving it the title "Being with the World." Being with the world, and I'll go on to explain what I mean about that. But in one thing, I wanted to share, maybe just because we live in a crazy, mysterious world, and I just read about this in Tricycle Magazine. I'm a mindfulness meditation teacher, but I also teach people. I train people in to teach mindfulness meditation. So I get a little concerned about how meditation and mindfulness is being introduced or overwhelmed by the mainstream. So, just to let you know, in a new high or a new low or a new extreme in mainstreaming meditation, about a month ago or so, Mattel introduced Meditation Barbie. Is this true? Meditation Barbie. And I was thinking if they called her Mindfulness Barbie, I would just quit teaching and I'd live in a hut somewhere and you never see me again. So, I can maybe handle Meditation Barbie. She's part of the Wellness Collection. And it's a Breathe With Me Barbie. And this is true. In the literature, it says she's starting to meditate because of her increasingly busy and overconnected world. And in the Tricycle article, they quipped that she can be your Dalai Lama, Dolly. But she can sit in a half lotus. She's got all kinds of joints. And the good news is her feet are flat. They're not at an angle for high heels. And also, apparently, her body proportions are more normal. That's what meditation does for you. Flattens your feet and makes you more normal. I don't know. But there is also a critique of you push her necklace and she gives instructions. And there's been a definite critique, a negative critique of her meditation instructions. So she needs a little more training. So just in case, maybe you have a child in your life who wants a Barbie, maybe this is a direction to go. In the article, it was kind of, at the end, it was sort of like, is this a good thing or a bad thing? And who knows, you know. But there it is, just so you're informed. And actually, Mattel is in partnership with Headspace. And Headspace is going to offer meditations for Barbie owners. I don't know. So there we have it. Being with the world is things like that. But I also am obviously wanting to talk about the more challenging and disturbing side of being with the world today. Some of you know, a few months ago, well, in December, both in this group and in the Ocean Gate group, I asked for questions, what people wanted me to talk about. And one of the things that came up a few times was about dealing with our challenging world situation and how to respond or live with that in various ways. And related to that, and another common question that came up a few times was around aging, illness, and death, and things around that, and these kind of intersect. And last month, I talked more about aging and death. So we'll put these all together. Of course, we know that Barbie doesn't age, so I don't think maybe not such. She's the only thing in the world that's not subject to aging, illness, and death. So, we live in a difficult world. a difficult and disturbing world in many ways, a beautiful and wonderful world in many ways. This has always been true, and but it does seem like it's reaching ahead in certain ways for many of us. Seems like the frightening and disturbing and threatening aspects of the world are becoming more obvious and less deniable. And it does seem like there are forces with power that are what I would say working in delusion to hasten the demise of many things we hold very sacred or important to us. The natural world, of course, and also many of the values that many of us are, as decent human beings, as Dharma practitioners, many of the values that we think are most important. So a lot of people are feeling the distress that comes with this. It's like, this is, you know, particularly since the 60s, I was alive and well and active in the 60s. And that felt like a very difficult and challenging time, and for some of the same reasons. And it was the early on about climate change, which at that time was greenhouse gases and talking about then. And also the Vietnam War. We had a challenging president at that time. And dirty deeds going on. So over these decades, for me, it's sort of like I can, you know, it sort of seems like we're getting better in some ways and we're not in other ways. And sort of waiting for the different shoes to drop, you might say. And it's beginning to feel like the shoes are dropping. That's, you know, in terms of climate change and other issues. And it does seem, it's hard to say where this is going to go, and I'm going to say more about that. I don't mean the talk, I mean the future. but we're certainly aware of the greed, hatred, and delusion, which are the three basic poisons that the Buddha talked about, that unless we really address those, unless we really train the heart and mind, that those will be predominant. And of course we see that around us. So my question I'm going to put out there and is, what have the teachings and practices taught us, or how have they prepared us for the many things that are happening now? That's sort of my question. I'm not looking for an answer at this moment from you, but I might in a little while. What has practice, meditation practice, Dharma practice, mindfulness practice, awareness practice, heart opening practice, what has this given us? What understanding have we gained from the various teachings? How does it help us? What I wrote down here was face the music of the world. You know, one of the most common things I hear from friends, friends, Dharma teachers, friends who are serious and long-term practitioners, and some of them are teachers, people who are really committed to this path, after they've gone through a really hard or difficult situation, perhaps, you know, a loss or a health issue or whatever it might be that we all go through, I hear them say, thank God I have my practice. Thank God I have my practice. Or the other thing I hear from these friends is, I don't know how people get through without a practice, without their practice. So what does that mean? What are they talking about? Well, one thing they're talking about is how we meet with How we meet disturbing, distressing, difficult, challenging, painful experience. What is our attitude and perspective when that happens? And as we know, the first noble truth is suffering happens. And we're none of us exempt to that. So I think one of the things with what I might call a seasoned practitioner, someone who integrates their practice deeply, not perfectly. I know no perfect practitioners. I know no perfect people. And I think that perfect person is an oxymoron. Imperfect person is a basic truth. I think one of the things that without missing a beat, you might say, that or maybe a few beats, but pretty soon after one is confronted with a difficult situation, that the practitioner, the seasoned practitioner, will turn toward the unpleasantness, will turn toward the physical, mental, and emotional challenge of the situation. And we'll ask the question, can I be with this? Can I be with this too? Can I allow this too? And if other stuff comes up, you know, learning from that, seeing one's own fears and limitations, that the seasoned practitioner sees this as, this is what I'm practicing for. This is why I practice. Because these things happen, whatever this thing is. And what can I learn? And can, as I said, be with this too. Be with this experience too. Can I open to this too? Can I allow this too? Recently, speaking of unpleasant experiences, just a week ago, I had a colonoscopy. Which is a very unpleasant. The colonoscopy is, any of you who've had these know that the colonoscopy itself is not necessarily, it's not great because you're in the hospital and weird things are being done to you. But the really unpleasant part is the first part. And I was talking to a friend who was a Dharma teacher, and she had had a series of, where she's telling me about a series of serious back surgeries she had, and we were kind of just, you know, commiserating. Around unpleasantness. But again, the thing was that these weren't seen as problems or intrusions or they shouldn't be happening, but as, this, as I said, this is why I practice, because of these things. Can I turn toward this? Can I be with this? Can I extend my ability to be present that much further? And I often, you know, I talk to people individually and in groups a lot, and I do often hear people say something along the, something difficult. And, you know, I'm talking to them about a loss or something happening in their lives, and they say, oh, yeah, this is happening. I can't practice, or I'm not practicing. It will be their comment about, you know, that, oh, I went through this and I couldn't practice while it was happening. And my response to that is, difficult situations are your practice. Mm-hmm. First of all, I think you are practicing probably with a difficult situation. You're having some very limited view of what practice is, and you're saying you're not doing that. But difficult situations are your practice. Facing those situations is your practice. Waking up to whatever arises is your practice. It's not an interference. It's not a mistake. It's not, oh, if I was a better person, this wouldn't be happening to me. It's not whatever you might bring to it. That's just another thing to be aware of. Is this making sense? So understanding this, it doesn't make you look forward to challenging. I don't look forward to colonoscopies at all. I don't wish them on anybody. At the same time, when I get the next one, that will be my chance to practice a certain kind of discomfort with a certain kind of discomfort. With a certain kind of fear, anxiety. Some of you know my partner had a colonoscopy last summer and had colon cancer. And he had to go in and have surgery and so forth. So there's also that knowing that that can be the outcome. The turning toward it. This is how we grow. This is how we learn. This is how we see truth and wisdom. This is how we see ourselves. This is how our heart breaks open. This is how we live our practice. So this floundering, ailing, scary, beautiful, magical, mysterious world is the place of our practice, all of it. This is the meaning of the whole catastrophe. We practice with the whole catastrophe. And these conditions are the conditions of practice. While I was putting this together, I just recall the book I'd read when I was, I think in college or maybe high school, called I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. Other people have read the book. And it was a meaningful read to me when I read it many years ago. But the title comes from it's been decades since I read it, so you can correct me if I don't summarize this right. But the therapist, it was someone, part of the book is going through a therapeutic experience, therapy, for deep difficulty and trauma. And the comment, I never promised you a rose garden, was kind of like, this isn't all butterflies and roses. This is this path of healing and this path of awakening. Is a big deal. It's really taking on the practice of life and death. It's really confronting full on the whole range of our experience and our existence. And while there's rose gardens, there's also garbage heaps. And while there's incredible wild beauty, there's also destruction. And our job is to step forward with all of it. Not to just end in the rose garden and that's it. Although that sounds kind of nice to me. that's not the point. So we don't practice so that everything becomes nicey nice and hunky dory, because guess what, it won't. But one of the metaphors that are used for this is that our daily practice of mindfulness, of meditation, of coming back to our heart, of coming out of our trance and our distortions and our confusion as much as we can, again and again, of connecting with others again and again. It's the metaphor that's sometimes used. It's like daily sewing of a parachute. Every day you're making your parachute a little bigger and a little stronger. And it has more capacity over time. Because you're damn well going to need that parachute at different times in your life. with the different things that happen, with the losses and the challenges and the frightening things. And an incomplete parachute is better than none. And the parachute, to sort of use this metaphor, which has its limitations, but what it does is it's the parachute of practice allows us to slow down, allows us, gives us a little bit more space, gives us a little bit more openness, gives us more perspective, and it softens the landing. So one thing I want to offer you is what I see for myself as a longtime practitioner is one of the gifts of this practice is perspective, opening, widening, enlarging perspective. That can mean many, many things. But one of our pitfalls is we get really contracted and our perspective gets very narrow and small and focused on our limited to our particular suffering or difficulties or neuroses. Those are fine to give attention to, but if we're limited to that, we're quite it's quite painful and it's quite work stuck. So also some of you have heard me talk about, and I mentioned I use this, which I'm not going to go into a lot of detail right now, but this three levels of human experience of the pre-personal, the personal, and the transpersonal. And I'm putting a lot of what we get from meditation and mindfulness and our various practices into the transpersonal category. Transpersonal means beyond oneself, essentially, beyond the personal. And so it has its, by its very nature, as we start to get unhooked from a limited self-view. Limited self-view, and if you're interested in Sanskrit, no, in Pali, is Sakyaditi. So we're moving out of that limited self-view into a bigger view, into the big questions of who and what am I? What is this reality really? Having the big perspective, I would say, doesn't stop the difficult situations from happening, but it does alleviate some of the pain of the very small contracted view that we often live in. I'm a bit of a self-taught science nerd, and one of the ways I bring perspective into my view is perspective, and you'll see this actually in a lot of the teachings in different ways. Not exactly from the science perspective, but science helps. The vastness of the universe and the mystery of the universe. So I'm just saying that's one thing I keep coming back to. To disengage me from a really small view into something bigger. And just on Friday, you might have seen this in the news, was the 30th anniversary of the Voyager spacecraft sending back the picture of Earth from 3.7 billion miles. People familiar with that photo? It's called the pale blue dot. It's not the nice marble photo. That's from, you know, the moon or nearby. This is the pale blue dot. An enormous, vast, empty space. And just this tiny 1 pixel worth of light. And this is a quote. The image shows our home planet as it truly is, a tiny, lonely outpost of life in an incomprehensibly vast cosmos. I wouldn't say this is exactly reassuring. When I say give perspective, I'm not saying it's necessarily reassuring, but it shifts one's view. And it gives one more pause. And for me, it gives one to give up a lot of the pettiness and confusion. And to reside in the mystery and openness instead. So, I just want to say, add in here some comments maybe, or just reflections on dealing with the impermanence of this pale blue dot, the impermanence of each of our lives, that is the most fundamental core teaching of the Buddha. I talked about this last month. That we come face to face without flinching or flinching and then turn back again to the changing, mysterious, impermanent nature of everything. So in this time and age where people are as we always have been, challenged by reflections on the loss of ourselves, reflections on the loss of loved ones, and we're also reflecting on the loss of this planet as we know it. And I think this brings a special kind of poignancy and grief to the forefront. And so I just want to name that. In observing or just talking to people, I find that people find some solace in life and in reflecting in their own death of knowing that if they have children, that their progeny carries on. I don't have children, so I don't have that to rely on. And also, I was talking to another friend of mine who's a Dharma teacher, and she says, I have find solace in the fact that nature will go on. Nature goes on. She doesn't have children. And then we both talked about what if our children and nature doesn't go on. Certainly not as we know it. Can we face that? And what does that actually give us a more raw experience of impermanence and uncertainty? This is from Woody Allen. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work, we could say through my family. I want to achieve immortality through not dying. I don't want to live in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live in my own apartment. And the point of that quote is, for me, is a couple of things, but we can have a variety of beliefs and ideas and so forth that actually insulate us from truth. And I want to encourage us to have the courage and amazing fortitude, because what this to face truth, what this world needs, as we all know, is more and more willingness to be honest and truthful. One thing I do want to add is that even though our natural world as it is under serious threat, and it's already diminished significantly in my lifetime, that the dear old planet Earth, dear old Gaia, is going to go on and evolve and become other things. I'm not worried about planet Earth in that sense. I am deeply worried about all the beings that are here now, find this home and so forth. Lynn Margulis, who's a microbiologist at the University of Massachusetts, ex-wife of Carl Sagan, one of the creators of the Gaia hypothesis, is quoted as saying, Gaia's a tough bitch. In the sense of, look, the Earth's going to go on no matter what we do to it. And it will evolve and things will happen. That's not to justify what we're doing. But it's also an interesting addition to expanding our perspective. But all of this, what I'm saying, brings me to a related topic, which is grief. And I'm doing a few comments about grief as a path to awakening. Maybe. Grief as the path to truth. Grief as the path to melting the heart. Jack Engler, who's a psychologist, Dharma teacher, in his dissertation many, many years ago, his points, which was about meditation and psychology, meditation as it comes from the East and psychology in the West and all kinds of things, was the practice as a way of grieving. The practice is really how we learn to grieve the nature of everything, because everything is impermanent. Becoming comfortable with grief and with letting go and with loss. Don't have to like it, but becoming more graceful and fluid and flexible. As things go, letting them go. Because we are wired to connect. We are wired to hold on to things, to survive. And we're wired to be sad when we lose things and loved ones. And it's important to know that grief is a reflection of our love.
Of our what love?
Our love. So I thought I would look at the traditional stages of grief in terms of our grief about the state of the world. And I do want to say that the stages of grief, this is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's original. There's a lot of things that have happened to the list since then, but that it's something we cycle through again and again and again. It's not like you do it and you're done. But all of the five stages in my mind relate to our practice of coming back to the truth of the here and now. And the truth of impermanence. So the first stage of is denial. Do we see any denial in the world today? I see a world in a flame in denial, actually, all kinds of denial. And the basic message of denial is this is not happening. What's happening is not happening. This is not happening. And we can see in ourselves how we might do that. And you can see how our practice to come back to the simplicity of here and now is the antidote. The second one is anger. See any anger in the world today? And the basic message in this context around this is it shouldn't be happening. First one is what's happening isn't happening. Anger is it's happening, but it shouldn't be happening. And maybe on a certain level, a lot of it shouldn't be happening, or it could be otherwise. But there is a level of, a certain kind of anger has a level of denial to it. And the next stage is bargaining, and I see a lot of people in bargaining too. Maybe it won't happen if I do such and such. Maybe only if this, only if that. I see it in people, you know, just give me the one gem of wisdom and then I'll feel okay and this all won't be so bad. The next one is depression. And I think in this sense, depression means a lot of things. I'm a psychologist, so I don't want to oversimplify these things too much. But in this context, it kind of means collapse when all the old forms and ways of being collapse for a while. I had a friend, her beloved husband died last fall of cancer, and she wrote an email, and the subject line was "Holy H-O-L-Y, holy collapse." Mm-hmm. She was in a state of holy collapse, and I think some of us are familiar with this. And then the last stage in the traditional five is acceptance. Real acceptance, Dharma acceptance, radical acceptance, which means a kind of giving up the resistance, giving up all the struggles against what's really happening, giving up our delusions, giving up that, and simply being with what is. And any of you who've experienced that for even a few moments, this radical acceptance, this real freedom acceptance, is quite while it lasts. It's quite amazing. It's quite peaceful. It's quite expansive. So I'm just putting these out for you to self-assess or kind of reflect on. As I was looking these steps up, I noticed online that there's all these additional steps, you know, Now there's a step six and, you know, whatever. And I thought, is there another step? And I said, you know what I put? If there's another step after acceptance, I would simply say love. That's all you're left with after that. That's all you're left with. And it's everything. And yet we cycle through again and again this denial and resistance and this anger and this trying to fix it and make it right through the bargaining and depression. And I'm doing this every day. I don't know about you. I'm not saying I'm beyond this. But I, as I said earlier, I'm fascinated by this. How am I navigating this territory? How does any of us navigate this? So, I want to say a couple more things, and then we have some time for comments or questions. I want to revisit another. I talked about this last year, some talks, and different places have brought up the concept of, there's a book called Deep Hope, and different people are working with the idea of deep hope. So I thought hope was a nice topic to come around to after all of this. This deep hope is different than our ordinary sense of hope. And some ordinary sense of hope is this, I think things will be okay, or I'm only okay if things will be okay, or that kind of thing, despite evidence otherwise. But in deep hope, you don't know, will things be okay or not. You don't know. And that's the point of deep hope. It's a kind of not jumping to conclusions. It's a kind of remaining open to possibility, potential. So deep hope isn't the opposite. I mean, the opposite of deep hope, no, how do I want to say this? That the, I'll just say, the other thing we can get caught in, which is deep despair. And that's the belief that things will not be okay. And that's as not true as things will be okay. It's equally unknown. I'm more prone to, oh, everything's going to go to, you know, whatever. But the truth is we don't know. And deep hope lives from that don't know. I was trained with Zen Master Sung Sung, the originator of don't know mind. And this is the fruition of don't know mind. Can you live from that? Don't know, but live authentically. Deep hope is that not jumping to an end, result, what will be, but to live from what we find most real and truthful and honest and meaningful. I also, as I was looking at things, found a book called Wild Hope, which I liked. And this is a quote from this book description. These stories also wake in us a wild hope that from all this death and ruin, something new could arise. Something new will arise. That's what that new is, we don't know. So the last time, last month, someone, I don't know if that someone is here, said, had a question of, you know, how do I live my last phase of life? What, you know, and that's a really good question. I feel like every phase of my life, I'm wondering, how do I live this phase of my life? And every day we have choices and influence. And there's a meme going around on Facebook, which someone sent to me or I saw, and then I sent it out. So this is my advice, how to live the rest of your life. The first part of it is stop being Democrat or Republican. Be honest. Have morals. Show empathy. Value integrity. be a good human. And that's what my advice to you. So, the very last thing I'm going to share is, and some of you heard part of it, or more of this than, because I shared this at my last day long, and several of you were there. This is from Jack Kornfield and Tara Brach. And this was sent to all the people being trained as mindfulness meditation teachers in the program that I'm teaching in. There are many times in recent history when things looked pretty bad. The Great Depression, the World Wars, the Vietnam War, genocide in Rwanda and Croatia, and so on. Violence will keep occurring. Yet from a larger perspective, as Steven Pinker describes in The Better Angels of Our Nature, these last centuries show us a great reduction in violence. And I'm going to interject here. There's a PBS program called The History of Violence, recent. I'd recommend watching it. It explains this very reduction, which I was dubious about until I saw. Centuries show a great reduction in violence and lives lost in war and torture and the great isms of racism and sexism. And you might say, yes, but life on Earth has never been so threatened. And it's true. And also, we have never had so much science, intelligence, and collaboration moving us toward healing. Humans are survivors, and in our difficulties, we are being forced to find a new way forward. Perhaps the most hopeful thing is this. The healing of our world requires a shift in consciousness, and it's happening. Never have so many people been intentionally training their hearts and minds and bringing mindfulness and compassion into action through dialogue, restorative justice, processes of reconciliation, and social action grounded in caring versus anger and hatred. You are in a position to remind others that awakening hearts and acting from love are the key to changing our world. A great and painful delusion is that we're facing a suffering world on our own. We're in this together. There are huge and growing numbers of people who actively care. And as Fred Rogers said, look for the helpers. If we and our students, we all remember that we're holding hands. If we keep coming home to presence and caring, if we then act in small and large ways from that caring, we will find peace in the midst and be part of this healing. So take a moment with that. Okay, that was a lot to take in. Any, before we end, and I'll do a dedication, any comment or question? I'd love a few comments. Yeah.
I'm recalling this quote from the movie Marigold Hotel. This is the fellow that was behind the desk that created the hotel in India, and he had these elders that were all complaining to him, and his comment was, well, in the end, everything will be okay. And if it's not okay, it's not the end.
It's not the end, yeah. I heard a quote somewhere recently, isn't it amazing that all those thorns come with roses? Sort of switching it around.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah. Anybody else? How to what?
How to become a good healer.
Healer.
Yeah. Well, that's a big question. Well, in this, there are many ways, but in this context, it's to heal yourself simply and to offer that a kind of a caring and compassion to others. That's the most fundamental. So we'll start there, or end there. Okay, we do need to end. Any last thing? Thank you very much for your patience and your attention. And I hope something of this morning and time together was of value to you. And I do really value getting together and being able to practice for a half day and sharing responses to some of the current concerns that people have. So again, thank everybody. So take a breath. And may we dedicate and offer up any insight, any benefits, any good heart, any understanding, any wisdom that has arisen from our time together and our practice together, and offer that up outward to all beings, knowing that all beings want to be happy and want to not suffer, knowing that all beings have within them the capacity for love and freedom, and to all beings that they too may awaken and find that freedom.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.